Hello, welcome to Off Curve. I'm Wicked Good, and I am talking to you about Hearthstone as I am driving to the supermarket. It is Sunday, September 13th, 2020, and so when we last spoke, I was, enjoying the fruits of 11X, and was close to getting to Legend with Mally Druid, and I'm happy to say that I got there on stream right after recording that last episode. So that was it's funny how different the 11X climb is, because it just felt very almost relaxing in a way, weirdly. I came in at around 600 Legend. I've dropped to about 2500 to 3000, just because I've not been super tryharding, and I've also been trying to learn a lot of the decks for both THL and for casting. So I've been sacrificing my rank for that. I've found some success with some things. The druids have been fairly kind to me when they cooperate. Priest is coming back after the nerf, and that's been working out fairly well. Soul Demon Hunter's working out reasonably well. Just kind of using a few of those. I've been trying to learn Tempo Mage. I tried to learn Turtle Mage for a little bit, and I don't think that deck is quite for me. But it's something at least I needed to know enough to be able to cast it, so that was worth my time. I'm using this as more of an educational experience right now, and just trying to learn things. I may start trying to repair my rank towards, later in the month, but for right now, it's been good to have that time, and I think that there's definitely something to, it's a little bit weird when you do get into Legend this early in the month, because you started a rank, and then people come in and push you down, regardless of whether you're actually playing well or not. So even though your win rate may not necessarily reflect negative progression, that's kind of what happens anyway, just because the people who come in with a better MMR than you are pushing you down, and it's a weird feeling. And I'm not, this is a first world problem, to be sure, right? this is not exactly, a normal thing. And I don't really want to get used to this either, because I do appreciate being at a point where I was able to get into Legend that early and not have kind of the stress of the Legend climb hanging over me for the first half of the month. But it's something to keep in mind, and it's something I have to keep reminding myself too, that you're not your rank, you know what I mean? And just because the number says something doesn't necessarily mean that's a reflection of your skill. Even when I'm having a bad day on ladder or whatever, and I've definitely had some of those. I had one day yesterday where I just could not focus at all, and I was playing the wrong cards. When I'm distracted, I'll play the wrong card with the same cost, and this was the wrong card with the wrong cost. And I was at that point just can see I need to do something else today. This is not a day to be laddering. Those kinds of days happen, right? And it's just a matter of recognize that that's something that's happening, and regardless of where you are at the ladder, you generally have the luxury of being able to take a day off here and there because of the change of the system. And so it's kind of good to recognize that. So I did that. I might try to climb a little bit more today and kind of try out some of these lists from Master's Tour, which is one of the things I want to talk about today, because I've been, as you know, if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, and I'm sure a fair number of you might have come from that in the first place, I do collect the Masters Tour statistics at offcurve.com/Masters Tour for the qualifiers and the Masters Tour events. So this weekend was Masters Tour Montreal, and so that's generally when the dashboard will get the most attention. Because, as much as qualifier data is interesting, that's mostly interesting to people playing in qualifiers, but people tend to pay more attention across the board when there's a Masters Tour event, both because, it's a little bit more, it's something you can watch and people want to see the data that goes along with it. Also because this is kind of the best event that we have to determine what's actually good in the meta, like, objectively. Now, there are still, you know, there are still biases there, right? Like, it's a small sample size. Even though it's a large event, it's still a relatively small sample size, especially with some of these more niche lists that are being brought, right? There is a ban involved, so the win rates may not necessarily be representative of the deck's actual performance. Like, Bomb Warrior is a great example, where this meta was basically ban Bomb Warrior or target Bomb Warrior. So if anyone who was leaving Bomb Warrior up had a plan to deal with it, and so it had like a 35 or 40% win rate over the course of the weekend. And that's not a matter of saying, like, Bomb Warrior is bad. It's a matter of saying, like, if you know that your opponent is likely to bring Bomb Warrior, then, and you just need to, and the idea with Conquest, right, is that all of your decks need to get through. So if you can hard target one deck in your opponent's lineup and just make sure it never gets through, then you kind of win through attrition, right? It doesn't really matter what the rest of the matchups are. If you can make sure that you have a list, a lineup that prevents Bomb Warrior from ever winning, then you get there eventually, even if it takes you five games to get there, right? So that seems to be what a lot of people did. Either they banned the Bomb Warrior, or they had a, like, there were some list lineups rather that ran like two Cobalt Sticky Fingers and an Ooze in like every lineup. And that's clearly for Bomb Warrior. Like, that's like, I'm not letting you keep weapons. You know, good luck, right? So some of these win rates in particular do need to be taken with a grain of salt because of the way that the meta's shaped up. Because on ladder, you're not going to have that experience, right? You're not going to be able to put two Cobalt Sticky Fingers and an Acidic Swamp Ooze in your deck on ladder and then expect to climb, unless you're facing literally like 90% Bomb Warrior, which is unlikely. But what we can do is we can look at the archetypes that are there. And one of the things that I put into the dashboard over the last couple of weeks is I've been working in card inclusion data. So actually breaking down the list. I mean, I already have the cards in the list for doing deck classification. And so I've managed to get that into the dashboard, and then we can see both how popular those cards are to be brought. I'm adjusting for rarity when I do that, when I do the popularity, which means that basically I'm multiplying the number of legendaries by two, just to make sure that it shows up equally in the graph. And then I'm basically taking the number of copies of a card in over all the lists that were in that archetype, and then I'm dividing it by the number of lists to get an average number of copies in the list. So you can kind of see, like, how often is this card brought at all? How often is this copy a one of? You know, that sort of thing. But then the next thing I was able to do was link that to game win rates. So what we can see is when we have variations in the list, right, what is the difference in win rate? Now, sometimes I'm still kind of working on how to display this, because if you have like a couple of fringe brings, like the difference in win rate is still overwhelmingly weighted towards the more popular version of the list. But you can see some things by when people either chose to bring a card or chose not to bring a card, like how that affects the win rate. So I want to go through a few of these. I tweeted these out last night as I was going through them, and I think it's kind of worth talking through some of these things. Now, all of these things come with a big caveat, right? Which is that small sample sizes are small. And so, and again, there is this tournament meta that's a little bit different. So I'm not saying that you should take any of this and change the way that you're building your decks immediately to account for this, because the data is the king. Like, I would not say that, right? What I am saying is that these are things that look interesting, right? And so they merit a little bit more investigation and experimentation. Like, there are some things that people tried, either by inclusion or omission, that had a variance on win rate, And so it's worth looking at that and seeing if there's something there. So one of the simpler ones that we can look at is that there's been two ways to build a survival druid. I have to actually have to change the name of it in the dashboard, I'm realizing, because I'm still calling it Guardian Druid, and I really should just call it Survival Druid, because it's survival of the fittest that's determining that archetype anyway. But so there's a couple different ways to build survival druids since the Kael'thas nerf. Some lists are running Kael'thas, some are not. Some are running exotic mount seller, one or two copies, sometimes with Kael'thas, sometimes not. And a version that does not run Kael'thas goes with a heavier package with Emerald Explorers and King Feoris at the top end. And that typically runs two copies of Survival of the Fittest, which makes more sense when you're running King Feoris, because King Feoris wants you to have expensive spells in your hand when you play it. So you can capitalize off of like the second copy of Guardian Animals that sometimes does nothing except maybe trigger a Speaker Ghidra. You have two copies of Survival of the Fittest that can make 10 drops, right? Even like leftover overgrowths can make some decent sized minions. And you run fewer copies of like the zero cost spells or the spells that get reduced to zero, like Bog Beam and Ironbark. You don't run those typically because you're looking for big bombs. So what that means is that if you get the time to set up against a slower deck, you have more waves of threats. Because you can play a Feoris, you have double Survival of the Fittest, so you can turn your dragon boards into like Savage Roars one more time, right? And like those waves get progressively harder to deal with in the late game. However, what that also means is that you have no plan B if you miss your ramp, right? Like at least in like the lighter list or the list that are running Kael'thas or even not running Kael'thas but relying on like mount seller stuff, you can do is you can use your bog beams, you can use your iron barks. You have some tools for early removal to help stall you to get to guardian animals if you miss. Or overflow if you miss on your ramp. And this has none of that. You have Animated Broomstick is basically your only proactive tool in this list. And it's just relying on just being able to stabilize with like big taunts and stuff. So what the data shows us is that that's not the right approach. Like the win rate for lists that had King Feoris in the list. And I'm just talking about overall deck win rate when I'm talking about win rate now. I'm not talking about played or drawn win rate. I'm not tracking that data because I don't get it. And even if I did, if you've listened to this show for any period of time, you know how I feel about those metrics. And if you haven't, my thought is that they're bad and they should feel bad. So, and you can go listen to, I'll probably link one of the episodes where I've talked about that in more detail to kind of help you understand that if you haven't already heard my spiel, because this episode is going to be an hour if we talk about that. But suffice it to say, I'm talking about just like game win rates of those lists, right? Like if you were to go on the Dex tab of HS Replay and just look at that, that would be that first win rate, the deck win rate. But the deck win rate for the King Feoris lists in the tournament was significantly lower than it was for the list that were running Mount Sellers or Kael'thas. So I think that that's kind of, and it's not close either, right? Like it's a significant drop. So I think that in general with Survival Druid, we're looking to you just don't have that kind of luxury, right? There was also a lot of Face Hunter in this tournament. And there's the aggressive rogues were kind of one of the better lists to bring also. So, again, ladder may be a little bit different, but I think if you're going survival druid, you probably want to be looking at a mount seller build, with or without Kael'thas. Kael'thas seemed to be closer to the average win rate than Feoris was, but Feoris is definitely not the way to go there. So there are a couple of other interesting kind of individual choices in a couple of popular decks that, seem to be kind of settled. And it looks like they're not. So Soul Demon Hunter has kind of been... The build's been kind of stabilizing for a while. And one of the most recent discussions has been around whether you need Lorekeeper Polkelt in the list or not. So, like, in case you haven't played a lot of Soul Demon Hunter, basically what happens is that most of your heavy hitters are cost 5, right? So the 3 cards that you have that cost more than that is one copy of Soul Sociologist Militia, and then 2 copies of Skull. So what you're trying to do with Lorekeeper Polkelt is play Polkelt, then you have a dead turn where you're drawing Militia, and then you Skull, your Skull gets your other Skull and either 2 of either Glaivebound Adept or Soul Shard Lapidary, and then you just start jamming all that damage straight at face. And generally, like, a control deck can heal up or armor up out of some of that damage if it's spread out over the course of the game. But when you're hitting your opponent for 9 to 12 every turn for like 3 or 4 turns, it's a lot harder for them to be able to recover from that, especially when Marrow Slice is right behind it. And then you also have Blade Dance in order to in order to remove threats that will keep you from getting a face, and like assuming that you have that in your hand already, right? So like generally against a slower deck, it's pretty backbreaking if you get Polkelt early enough to matter. Against control decks, it's basically unplayable. I don't know if it's unplayable, but you just won't have time, right? Because, like, it involves you having everything you need to take a turn off. If you're being pressured heavily, you're probably not going to have everything you need. And then against Bomb Warrior, it just doesn't work, right? Because you're going to have your deck shuffled. Now, again, this could be part of the Ban Warrior strategy. Like, if you're bringing Soul Demon Hunter, you're probably planning to Ban Warrior. And if you're banning Warrior, then you can put Polkelt in, because the problem with Bomb Warrior is that every time that they put a bomb in your deck, it gets shuffled. So you can play Polkelt, and then they just swing with a weapon, and now all of a sudden you basically just played a Chillwind Yeti. But if you ban a Warrior, then that works. Now, so, and it seems like in, you know, the feud list that did include it, like, it's not close, right? It's like close to 60%. But again, that's 60%. Again, we have to be careful about context here, because that's 60% likely in a Ban Warrior lineup, which is not going to be your case on ladder. However, it is worth noting that, because Conquest is a thing. Like, people play in qualifiers still, and Conquest tournaments are still a thing. If you're playing Conquest and your strategy is Ban Warrior, then it may behoove you to put Lorekeeper Polkelt in your deck, because it's going to be that much better. So, again, there's a lot of ifs there. I don't know if this means that you put it back in your list for ladder, but certainly for Conquest with a Ban Warrior strategy, or if Bomb Warrior starts to take a step back, I think we can start considering Lorekeeper Polkelt again, because this, all of this data indicates, and we have to, you know, dig in a little bit more deeply if we wanted to do some serious analysis on this. This is just off of, like, a first pass at, like, 10 o'clock last night. But it does seem to imply that you can get a higher win rate with Polkelt if you're not worried about it getting reshuffled, and you can handle some of the aggro decks. So Tempo Mage has had some interesting data there as well. It looks like the package of Arcane Breath and Cobalt Spellkin, which Orange has been touting for quite a while, overperformed over the rest of the versions of the list. And, you know, that's something that, you know, and I don't even know if it's necessarily the Arcane Breaths that matter there as much as it is the Spellkin, just to get the extra 1 mana spells to be able to fuel the rest of the deck. Because, like, Arcane Breath is, I mean, it's good early removal against some of the faster decks, but certainly the Spellkin seems to be the part of that equation that matters the most. But what was more interesting when I was looking at that list is Jandis Barov has a lower win rate than average. And Jandis was only left out of, like, 3 or 4 lists out of, like, 55. But it's interesting that she has, like, a 2% lower win rate overall, which is pretty significant when you're talking about only a couple of lists that left it out, right? Now, again, small sample sizes are small, but I do wonder, and I've been playing a fair amount of Tempo Mage myself lately, just trying to learn it, and it does feel like Jandis is kind of clunky sometimes. Like, yeah, it's good if you need another Conjurer's Calling target, but a lot of the time, like, that just dropping a 5-drop to get the bodies, like, you don't necessarily have time to do it. And it might be that, you know, just using other things that work better with what the deck wants to do, maybe a strategy worth looking at, right? Because, like, I Jandis is just, like, an individually powerful tempo play, but it doesn't really do much that the rest of the deck wants to do aside from Conj Calling targets. And generally, you want to be hitting your Mana Giants with Conj Calling anyway. You don't really want to be hitting a 5-drop. So I thought that was interesting looking at that. I don't know what's there, but it might be worth, you know, seeing what those players are doing and what they're replacing Jandis with. And then see if that's a better overall with some ladder experimentation. So Turtle Mage is also it's a deck that's kind of being refined at the moment, and there have been a number of takes on it since Eddie won the specialist week of GM with it and confirmed that it is in fact a real deck that we need to be paying attention to. So there's been a couple of developments. One, like, normally the spell package is Blizzard, Frost Nova, and Potion of Illusion. You're only running 3 spells in the list because that's how many discover choices that the Tortolan Pilgrim will give you. And so you always want to make sure that you can get a potion or a freeze if you need it. What I believe Zanananan tried was, and he got a high finish with it, was replacing the Blizzard with Ice Barrier, and then usually you have one Battlecry minion that does direct damage. Normally it's a Sunreaver Mage, which does 4 damage if you have a 5-cost spell in your hand, but obviously if you cut Blizzard, you don't have that anymore. So replace that with Cloud Prince, which does 6 if you have a secret in play. So you can obviously always get a secret, and then that, you know, that does damage. So that build didn't perform significantly worse, but it did perform a little bit worse than the Sunreaver Mage build. But what was interesting to me when I was looking at the data for that list is that Imprisoned Observer and Astromancer Solarian are both core to the deck. Like, almost every person who runs the deck includes it and swear by those cards, right? Like, Astromancer Solarian just gives you an alternate win condition, and Imprisoned Observer is like a tool that you have against aggro decks specifically, just because it's able to clear the board, and then it's a 4/5. Both of those cards, lists that cut those cards, fared better slightly. Now, again, there were not many lists that chose to exclude them, but the ones that did performed about a percentage point higher than the ones that did include it, which I thought was interesting, because especially Imprisoned Observer seems to be like the card that everybody swears by, like, you never cut that, and you actually keep it in the mulligan. And the fact that card was underperforming is something that I think is worth looking at. I mean, Turtle Mage didn't perform great overall, but there are some significant differences in some of the builds that were there. Also, Bone Wraith way overperformed. There were not many people brought it, but the folks who did had a significantly higher win percentage. And it's, we're talking about from below 50% to significantly above 50%, like 55 or 60%. So maybe Bone Wraith is a better... you'd have to look at the individual list, and I don't have that. I probably need to figure out a way to build that level of detail in without trolling through all of the lists. And I'm not sure if I can find a way to show what they're not include, what those lists are not including. Like, that's the kind of thing I would like to do. I just need to figure out, like, how I would show it. And those are the kinds of things that are easy to say and hard to implement, really. It's very hard to show something that has a lack of data in a visualization tool like this, is kind of what I'm trying to say. But I think that that's interesting, that that Bonewraith might be the better anti-aggro tool. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it, because it does, it shows up immediately, and then it provides two bodies. And then if you bounce even the back half, right, like, you could trade off the front half and then Potion of Illusion the back half, and then get still get a fresh copy of it. So, you know, it kind of does the same, something similar. It doesn't provide a body to trade off with or do direct damage to a board, but it does kind of get in the way and be annoying. So that might be something to think about when looking at the Troll Mage list going forward. And Secret Rogue also is a list that's kind of, it's been more in flux since the nerf. Like, it was finally starting to solidify, and then the nerfs came, and Secret Rogue is probably least affected out of all the rogue nerfs by the Secret Passage nerf. But, you know, everything's kind of, you know, it takes a little bit of a hit there. There's been some discussion about whether Ambush should be in the list or not, and there were some lists that, seemed pretty even, actually, a list that included Ambush and that didn't. And Ambush lists overperformed over the rest of the field of Secret Rogues. So that seems like something that, at least, again, that may be related to how you're, you know, what you're targeting. Like, Bomb Warrior doesn't play a ton of minions, but the list that you're going to be playing against if you're banning a Bomb Warrior kind of do. So, you know, that may have a little bit more value given the ban. But one thing that does seem pretty clear is that there were a few lists that tried the Vendetta and Dragon Sword package, and that just seems to not be the way to go. It's not even close, like, how low the win percentage was for those decks, for those lists versus the rest of the field. So I think, you know, it's pretty clear that the Vendetta's Dragon Sword package ought to come out. But the Ambush thing, that may just be a little bit of the meta, because it was a slight improvement. But it's probably worth having, you know, just for variants of Secrets, if nothing else. So this is something that I don't know enough Rogue to really understand why this would be, or this might just be variants. I don't know. Like, somebody who's smarter with Rogue, I guess, Had, if you're listening, like, explain me why this is. But so both Secret Rogue and Stealth Rogue occasionally decided to include Flick Skyshiv in the list. And the reason you're doing that is primarily for Turtle Mage, right? Like, if you have a list, and this is kind of going back to the whole, like, Flick Skyshiv versus Shervala the Tiger thing, right? If you have a list that revolves around playing a specific minion over and over again, or getting a specific minion in your deck over and over again, then being able to remove all copies of it just kind of shuts down that game plan, right? And what's funny is that you have the Stealth Aggro Rogue that's running, like, it's running Greyheart Sage, but it's also running, like, the Ashtongue Slayer, and it's running sometimes even Coldblood at the top end. But just, like, a more aggressive, like, low to the ground, really need Secret Passage to be good type of list. And you also have the Secret Rogue that I just talked about, which is more revolving around just generating stuff, right? Like, you're running Plagiarize, you're getting stuff in the way of your opponent, and you're trying to build up, like, a big questing adventurer or a big Edwin and just hit your opponent in the face with it. It's a lot more like Vicious Syndicate calls it Miracle Rogue, and I can't bring myself to do that, but I understand where they're coming from. So the Secret Rogues that included Flick underperformed versus the rest of them, but the Stealth Rogues that included Flick, like, way overperformed, like 7 percentage points over the ones that didn't. And I'm really curious about that. And I don't know if it's just a matter of, like, I don't know. I mean, obviously it's not a ban mage thing, though I guess maybe if you're playing Flick in your Secret Rogue, then you're leaving Mage up, and maybe that's just the wrong call for a lineup that includes Secret Rogue as opposed to Stealth Rogue, which might want to ban. I don't know what you ban with Stealth Rogue necessarily, because it might be that you would ban the Mage with Stealth Rogue with Secret Rogue, and then you shouldn't be playing Flick at all. meanwhile, you would probably leave the mage up, because that's the kind of deck you're trying to target with the Stealth Rogue. Because the way you're beating, like, Turtle Mage and, I guess, Bomb Warrior and, you know, other slow... And like, Druid and decks that take a few turns to spin up, is you just kind of want to get under them, right? And then Flick kind of gives you a backup plan if you get a slow draw. So that might be what it is. But it was really interesting to me that that one tech card in two of the same class just had such a different performance. And it's something to think about when you're trying to tech against a deck, right? Like, how much does that really do for you? Like, I was thinking about running oozes in, oh gosh, what? I guess in my priest or my warrior this week in THL, and Hat talked me out of it. So is that one who's really going to make that much of a difference for you beating Bomb Warrior or not? And I guess maybe it was the Soul Demon Hunter. And I said, no, you're right. It's probably not. It probably doesn't matter. I probably just keep the deck better, right? So it's tempting to like kind of tech against, unless you have a read that it's going to be most of the meta like Bomb Warrior was. Sometimes it's better to just, you know, build a lineup that bans out that deck if you're really worried about it, rather than trying to hard tech against it, unless you already have like a really good matchup against it and you're just trying to bully it. So there's also a few people who decided to continue to bring Zoo even after the Dark Lair nerf, and they were generally rewarded with it. Zoo was one of the better performing decks in the meta. It just took some rejiggering, and it'll probably take some more refinement now that Dark Lair only gives you back one mana crystal instead of two. But it's interesting that a couple of people tried to cut Dark Lair entirely, and that didn't work out for them. Like, those lists that didn't, like, Dark Lair was one of the highest performing cards of lists that were running it, meaning that decks that did not include Dark Lair performed significantly worse. But Penflinger underperformed, and I think that makes sense when you think about it, because a lot of the times what you were doing with Penflinger was like you'd throw it at your own face with the Dark Lair up, and then you get one of that mana refunded, and then you'd be able to do it again. And sometimes that's with a Raise Dead, so you'd end up with net three mana out of that deal if you Penflinger. Actually, it's more than that, right? Because you Penflinger your face, you'd pay one, you'd get two, so that's one. You'd Raise Dead, you'd get another two back for free. That would send the Penflinger back. Then you Penflinger yourself again, pay one, get two. So you're actually netting four mana off that whole deal. Now you break even at best, right? So like the Penflinger is really just there to get refreshed if you Soulfire or you Raise Dead, and that's not really good enough to justify continuing in the deck. So it makes sense that Penflinger would kind of underperform, but it seems like Dark Lair Zoo is still something worth looking at. It's probably a little bit more difficult to play. I know Meaty was saying that he did very well with it, and it, you know, it definitely rewards, you know, knowing how to use the tools in your deck appropriately, as opposed to just relying on things getting generated, like something like a Tempo Mage or a Priest Might. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on Zoo developments as kind of the week goes forward. I think this gives, if nothing else, it gives some incentive to want to continue to experiment with the deck. Like, it did very well on a per deck basis in the Masters Tour, which means there's something there, right? And on average, all the people who brought it, there weren't many people who brought it. I actually had to drop the sample size. Normally I'm limiting these things to at least, I forget if it's 5 or 10 lists that brought a card in order to include it in the graph. This one I had to drop it all the way down to 2 just to get rid of one ofs, but there were only 12 or 13 Zoolists in the tournament, so it was a much smaller sample size to begin with. But those 12 or 13 on average did well, right? And certainly the Dark Lair list performed even better. The non-Dark Lair lists were actually bringing the average down for that deck. So Dark Lair Zoo may still have some legs. It's just a matter of figuring out what the right mix of cards is to go into it. And so I've spent pretty much the whole episode talking about Bomb Warrior and the effect of you know, everyone gunning for Bomb Warrior in this meta, but I haven't talked about the actual card choices within Bomb Warrior. It does look like the Risky Skipper package, though it was intended to be anti-aggro, just was not performing as well overall. Like, if you're going to play Bomb Warrior, you really want to go all in on the bombs, and you don't want to have Ankar cluttering up your weapon pool for Horde Pillager. You want to be playing things like Sword and Board, and you want to be playing Cutting Class. You want to be playing like Coerce potentially. You don't want to be using up slots in your deck with the Pirate package, because it messes up your Horde Pillager, and it's one more one fewer weapon that you can grab through Corsair Cache, or one low roll on a Corsair Cache effectively. And it just doesn't seem to be, I mean, maybe it is good against aggro, but maybe this wasn't the environment where that mattered enough. And you're just giving up those points against the other matchups where you could be using it to its full advantage. I mean, the win rate was low overall, but it was even lower for the Pirate package list. And don't run Zephyrus. Zephyrus was one of the lowest, lists that ran Zephyrus were among the lowest win rate lists of Bomb Warrior. Even among the low win rate for Bomb Warrior. So Zephyrus just, like, there are other ways that are more consistent for you to get late game. Like, the Galakrond package seemed to be pretty good. You could even go back to running Grom if you wanted to, but I have to, look, I don't have the graph in front of me, so I can't tell you off the top of my head how Grom performed, but certainly I know that the Kronk's Galakrond package did well. So you shouldn't really be looking to run Zephyrus. Like, yeah, you do draw through your deck a lot, but it's inconsistent, and you have other ways of generating reach for the end of the game as Bomb Warrior without having to resort to Zephyrus. All right, so that's it for this week. Hopefully, this is interesting. I'm happy to do these kinds of data deep dives. If this is the kind of thing that is useful and interesting. I mean, I was kind of tweeting this out on Twitter last night, and this is really more of me going a little bit more in depth into how the tournament meta shook out and some of the things that I look at in terms of analysis. Like, I just kind of provide this dashboard for everyone to use on their own, but I do realize that, like, you know, making the data available and data, like, I do this as a guided analysis as best as I can, just knowing the kinds of things that you can potentially fall into as somebody who does this for a living. Like, my day job is in, I'm a data architect, for those of you who don't know. My day job is in analytics and business intelligence and dashboarding. I mean, it's also data warehousing and stuff like that too. Like, there's a lot that I do, but this is one thing that I do a lot. So I want to try to help, like, and I've been very critical of some of the other sites in the past as constructive criticism as much as I can make it. Cause, like, I think that everyone who's doing, data in the Hearthstone space is really trying to do the best job that they can. Like, I don't think there's anybody here who's just kind of like slapping up data and trying to just make a buck off of it. I think everybody kind of cares about furthering the conversation as best that they can, and just kind of in our own way, and we all have different specialties. But there are definitely ways that you can present this data that can be more or less useful and more or less subject to interpretation. But there's always interpretation involved, right? And so, like, that involves some of that critical thinking, and that's where, like, I don't play enough at this level to say definitively, like, this is why these things are happening, but I can take, like, what I know about the game and then, you know, interpret that with what I know about the data and try to make the best explanations that I can. But this will always be better with some more, you know, expert analysis. But anyway, all the data is available for you to look at offcurve.com/masterstour. That'll be there. I usually leave that up as a different tournament series even after that tournament's over. It'll go back to focusing on Madrid qualifiers after this week, but the data will still be there for you to peruse. You can also, if you're interested in when new updates to the dashboard or when new episodes for this show go live, you can follow Off Curve on Twitter at Off Curve. You can find the show notes for this show and every episode at offcurve.com as usual. You can follow me on Twitter at WickedGood, where I'll sometimes tease some of these things that I'm working on. I also, you know, occasional hot takes around the game, or, you know, sometimes political stuff, but, you know, whatever. You can follow me streaming on Twitch on Mondays and most Thursdays now that I'm casting House Rivalries occasionally. Mondays at 8 p.m. Eastern and Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern at twitch.tv/wickedgoodfm. You can also join the Discord. We have a lovely group of people who are very supportive and kind and wonderful and awesome and intelligent and handsome and beautiful and whatever at discord.offcurve.com if you want to talk about this stuff too. Most of all, just be good to each other. All right, we'll talk soon. Have a good one. Hello, welcome to Off Curve. I'm Wicked Good, and I am talking to you about Hearthstone as I am driving. Well, I'm not driving to work, and I'm not driving to work. I'm actually driving to go pick up dinner for. It's a Thursday. It's September 17th, and it's Maureen's birthday, so I'm going to get her some food from her favorite place that we have not been to in quite a while. So I finished working and then immediately went and placed an order, and I'm driving a fair distance away, but, I'm happy to do it. And so that's why I'm here, excuse me, talking to all of you, cause I have some time in the car to kill while I'm going to, retrieve a birthday dinner. So it's September 17th. My ladder is not really anything remarkable. I've basically just been trying to test out a bunch of decks for THL and casting. And it's not been great for my rank. And it's probably also partially that people are coming in ahead of me and I'm playing at times that I probably shouldn't be playing and whatever. But I'm at around 5,000. I'm fine with it. Like, I'm not really dropping all that much. My win rate's not terrible, but it's not... You know, it's not the kind that I'm going to be climbing out of those ranks. But I know that usually on the weekend, I'll be able to rescue that. So I'm not super worried about it. And I've been playing better decks and kind of learning them a little bit better, which is really the goal, right? Like, it's hard to learn on ladder, which is really where you have to learn if you're going to be playing against the kinds of decks that you need to be learning to play against. And so what I'm doing is I'm just trying to learn these decks and trying to play them against a bunch of stuff, and that's sometimes not fantastic for one's rank. So I'm about 5,000. I'm fine with it. And I'm hoping that will improve towards the end of the month, but I'm not, you know, I'm if it doesn't, I'm okay, right? Like, I got the 11x last month. I would love to get that back again. I'm okay if I don't, but, you know, we'll see. I ended up like 3,000 last month, and I ended up getting the 11x multiplier. So if I can do that again, or at least like maintain a good enough win rate to do that, then I'll be pretty happy with that.